has been ordered by regional authorities into one of the incidents, but families call it an eyewash. So what has contributed to this lack of trust?
Well, one thing that the world needs to understand is that there's no lack of trust between India and Kashmir. There is no trust, so to speak. So let's begin with that. There is no trust deficit. Kashmiris don't want India. And after 2019, even India's own collaborators have understood how vicious and how tyrannical and how neo-colonial India is. So the imperial heart of India has been seen by everyone. And I think the global world, the global community has also seen it. So whether it be a magisterial inquiry, which is the government's own people inquiring, or it be a judicial inquiry, both of them are pretty much the same, because both of them have created their own terrorism, their own brand of state terrorism for people, because they're props to the occupation. So it's not about trust. It's about occupation. It's about military occupation cracking down on people and creating these human rights violations, and then some format of this government machinery coming forth and saying, let's have a probe, let's have a judicial probe. Kashmiris have seen hundreds of probes that have produced no results whatsoever. Hundreds of probes, and some by the local government and some by, you know, different bodies, but nothing has ever produced anything. And I think it's high time we take into cognizance and we do not use the word trust between Kashmiris and India. There is no trust, so to speak. It's an out and out Indian military occupation that has been there for the last 74 years, and that needs to be addressed, and we need to understand India's neo-colonialism.
So why have the government crackdowns on activists, journalists and protesters intensified in the contested region? What is the objective in your opinion?
So the objective is repression of Kashmiri people. The objection is to make sure that the resistance movement is completely silenced, whether that be all types and formats of resistance movements. Kashmiri resistance movement is cultural, and they're making sure that they are trying to repress Kashmiris in all forms and manner. And for the last 72 years, 74 years, so to speak, from 1947 onwards, many, many laws have been passed that have essentially criminalized Kashmir's resistance movement. And what we see now is not something that's happening in this moment. This has been happening for the last 74 years. In the last 34 years, it has been increasing. And now we see the most repression that could happen, that is kind of right now wreaked on Kashmiri people and Kashmiri society. And as part of that, journalists are the canaries in the coal mine. So what they did in 2020 was they passed a law, which is technically a law that is a media gag. So they created conditions that media cannot even properly report from the places where fights are taking place. They made sure that journalists are essentially also booked under these terror laws. They also made sure that the bureaucrats are the ones who are deciding what's fake news, what's incitement. So the journalists have slowly and slowly faced the censorship that had been already going on, and they had been working under extremely terrible conditions. But from 2020 onwards, everything is institutionalized. So now you have that kind of a condition created where no one can report what's happening inside. Whatever is trickling out is really minimal. And at the same time, you're cracking down on activists. So no one can actually report to the outside world what's happening inside, the basic human rights violations, the tyranny, the cruelty of this Indian military occupation that's happening. No one can really report in the manner that they need to. So now the conditions are perfect. You know, anyone who can report from inside Kashmir to the rest of the world has to show government of India in a positive light, otherwise they will be thrown in the jail. So what we see, they created this condition, they institutionalized that nothing can go out reported without being vetted by the government, and as a result, the condition that has been created inside Kashmir at this present moment is one of extreme tyranny, that people are being killed in fake encounters. This is not new.
Thank you for your time, Mrs. Zia. Hope to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Indian journalist Samar Harlankar commenting on recent killings in Indian-controlled Kashmir, says one of the victims framed as a militant and tortured was a daily wager. UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders Mary Lawler says Khurram Parviz, a prominent Kashmiri human rights activist arrested recently, is not a terrorist. Anish Gawande, a student at Oxford University, reports about a massive protest held by students against extrajudicial killings and illegal detentions in Indian-controlled Kashmir.
And that was our episode on the hypocrisy of the host of the so-called Summit of Democracy and the deteriorating security situation in Indian-controlled Kashmir in the wake of the recent killings and arrests. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight. Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, Who Will Hold Prosecutors Accountable? Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. But why? Because they're protected by layers of silence and secrecy that are written into local, state, and federal policy, shielding them from any real accountability for wrongdoing. New York City offers a prime example of a problem endemic to the nation. Consider the city's official reaction to the barrel full of misconduct in Queens that a group of law professors recently brought to light. As the New York Times reported last month, the professors filed grievances against 21 prosecutors in the borough for everything from lying in open court to withholding key evidence from the defense, and then posted those grievances to a public website. These weren't close calls. In every instance, an appeals court had made a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. In many cases, the misconduct was so severe that it required overturning a guilty verdict and releasing someone from prison. Three men wrongfully convicted of a 1996 murder were exonerated after 24 years behind bars. But that rectified only the most glaring injustice. To date, none of the prosecutors have faced any public consequences. Some are still working. How did New York City respond to this litany of widespread misconduct by its own agents? It went after the professors who publicized it. In a letter to the committee that handles misconduct charges, New York City's top lawyer, known as the Corporation Counsel, accused the law professors of abusing the grievance process to promote a political agenda and of violating a state law that requires formal complaints about lawyers' conduct to be kept secret unless judicial authorities decide otherwise. And they virtually never do. The grievance committee agreed to punish the professors by denying them access to any future updates on their complaints, even though state law requires that complainants be kept informed throughout the process. The upshot is that the committee could dismiss the complaints tomorrow and no one would know. For good measure, the Corporation Council then sought to keep secret the letter requesting the law professors be punished for violating the secrecy law. This isn't just shooting the messenger, it's tossing the gun into the East River and threatening anyone who tries to fish it out. We know about all this because the law professors sued the city in federal court, claiming that the secrecy law infringes on the First Amendment. How could it not? If someone tells a New York Times reporter about a prosecutor's misconduct, the reporter is free to write a story addressing those allegations for all the world to see. But if the same person files a formal grievance about the same misconduct with the state, she is barred from talking about it. It's not even clear what the punishment for violating the law would be, as evidenced by the fact that dozens of prominent lawyers, including former New York judges and even prosecutors, went public with grievances they filed against Rudy Giuliani over his role in Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election and encourage the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. To date, none of these lawyers have faced public sanctions for speaking to the press. In theory, the secrecy law exists to protect lawyers from being smeared by frivolous complaints. But that rationale makes no sense when applied to prosecutors, who are public officials doing the state's work. In the Queen's cases, their misconduct is already a matter of public record. Even if it weren't, there is no principled reason to prevent the public airing of complaints, not to mention public hearings against officials who have the power to send people to prison. Certainly, the defendants they face off against in courts of law don't enjoy such privileges. New York shelters its lawyers from disciplinary measures more than most states in the country, even as it ranks near the top in total number of exonerations, a majority of which are the result of misconduct by prosecutors. Meanwhile, the few attempts to increase oversight of New York prosecutors have been stymied. A 2018 law established a commission specifically to deal with prosecutorial misconduct in a more independent and transparent way. But the State District Attorneys Association challenged it, and a court struck it down as unconstitutional. Lawmakers designed a new commission this year, but it appears that no commissioners have yet been appointed to it. New York's prosecutor protection racket is, alas, far from unique. In Washington, the U.S. Justice Department aggressively shields its own prosecutors from outside accountability thanks to a 1988 law that lets the agency essentially police itself. All other federal agencies and even parts of the U.S. Justice Department, like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, are subject to oversight by independent inspectors general, who conduct thorough investigations and issue lengthy reports with their findings. Federal prosecutors skate by on an internal review process that is run out of the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose head is appointed by and reports directly to the Attorney General. the office almost never makes its findings public, and when it does, it often provides only a brief summary months after the fact. In the words of one legal ethics expert, it's a black hole. By contrast, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department just released its semi-annual report, as it is required to do by law, detailing the 52 reports it issued between April and September of this year, as well as the closing of investigations that resulted in 68 convictions or guilty pleas and 66 firings, resignations, or disciplinary actions. The level of scrutiny that federal prosecutors are subject to matters so much because they're just as prone to misconduct as their state and local counterparts. Take the botched prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska on corruption charges, or the legal green light Justice Department lawyers gave interrogators to torture terrorism suspects, or the more recent revelation that Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal in 2008 from his prosecutor Alex Acosta, who later became Labor Secretary in the Trump administration. Yet, in the latter two cases, the Office of Professional Responsibility found no misconduct. Alex Acosta was guilty only of poor judgment, the Office of Professional Responsibility said. In the Senator Ted Stevens case, the office found misconduct but said it was unintentional, and it let the prosecutors off with a slap on the wrist. Have there been other similarly egregious failures to hold prosecutors to account? Almost certainly, but we don't know because the U.S. Justice Department doesn't tell us. There is no principled reason for federal prosecutors to avoid the accountability expected of all public servants. Their exemption from the general rule was adopted in 1988 as a favor to Dick Thornburg, who was then the Attorney General and had tried to derail the creation of an Inspector General for the U.S. Justice Department. Years later, Mr. Thornburg admitted he had been wrong. This is a highly professional operation that goes where the evidence leads and is not directed by the way the political winds are blowing, he said at a gathering marking the law's 25th anniversary in 2014. I've come to be a true believer, he said. So have large numbers of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable fact at the moment when the parties can't agree on the time of day. Their fix is straightforward. Eliminate the loophole in the 1988 law and empower the Inspector General to review claims against federal prosecutors, just as the office currently does in cases involving other Justice Department employees. A Senate bill co-sponsored by Mike Lee, Republican Senator of Utah, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, would do exactly this. Yet Attorney General Merrick Garland is continuing in the tradition of his predecessors by opposing any change to the existing system. Prosecutors can work in the interests of fairness and justice, but they can also cheat and destroy people's lives. They should be held accountable when they do that, both to vindicate their victims and to help ensure that they can't do it again.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant fact.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
بعد امام صادق مثال زد فرمود علم ینسب داوود.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in order to clarify the harms of the tongue of the people, gives us examples and states, didn't the people call Prophet Dawood a pigeon fancier, a person who is after playing with the birds? Or didn't the people accuse Prophet Dawood for being after the wife of Uriah, the commander of the army? Didn't the people call Prophet Moses a sterile man who is not able to have a baby?
لم ينسبوا جميع الانبياء الى انهم سهره نگفتن.
And then Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam continues, didn't the people call the prophets as magicians? Didn't they accuse Lady Maryam, daughter of Imran, for being pregnant from a carpenter? And didn't the people call Prophet Muhammad a poet? As you can see, even the prophets of Allah and the saints of Allah were not safe from the slander and backbite of the people of their time. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and since Jamadi al-Awwal is the month of the birthday of the Holy Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, we present you a wonderful saying from her husband, Abdullah ibn Ja'far al-Tayyar, regarding the noble daughter of Imam Ali, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon them, who cared for the comforts and ease of her brothers and sister, was generous to the poor, was generous to the homeless and the parentless. Zainab is the best housewife.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
With nearly 200 state members, Interpol is the only police authority that can claim to span the five continents. Its chief mission is to help arrest fugitive criminals and therefore contribute towards a safer world. However, with its new president at the helm, an Emirati security official accused of grave breaches of human rights, this international body ushers in a dangerous era where despotic regimes with deep pockets are being able to dictate international policing.
حادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Inspector General of the UAE's Interior Ministry, Ahmed Nasser Al-Raisi, will serve a four-year term at Interpol after winning a vote in Turkey on November 25. His candidacy was roundly condemned by a wide range of individuals and institutions.
So his first reaction when I heard he want to become a president of Interpol, it was shocked. I didn't believe that because, you know, he had direct responsible for my case on my colleague from Kuala as well. And so, yeah, and for me, it was a huge impact on my life, and it's absolutely changed my life to upside down.
A few days before the election, three European Parliament members sent a letter to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, warning the election of General Al-Raisi would undermine the mission and reputation of Interpol and severely affect the ability of the organization to carry out its mission effectively.
The UAE has been attempting to occupy, has been basically occupying the southern Yemeni island of Socotra since at least 2018, but also prepping to do that essentially in the decades prior, using it essentially as an illegal military base. And also that year, there have been a lot of discoveries of torture and sexual abuse in prisons by Emirati guards against Yemeni prisoners, too. So this is just an attempt for the Emirates to escape accountability and escape any just prosecution that should be brought onto it.
Al-Raisi's appointment follows generous, albeit suspicious, funding by the UAE for the body. Back in 2017, when the UAE's statutory contribution was a bit more than 230,000 euros, the country made a 50 million euro donation to the Interpol Foundation for a Safer World, an organization which lobbies governments and companies to support Interpol's work.
In 2017, specifically, the UAE pledged or donated about 50 million to seven different agencies within Interpol, with around 10 million pledged or donated in 2019. So it's obvious that they're bribing the France-based agency to not investigate its own role or to basically hush up any accusations that are continuously brought up against the UAE in seeking accountability against its actions.
Last year, when it was still hard to imagine a man of poor human rights record as the head of Interpol, the Telegraph revealed that the Emirati general was a shoo-in for the role, a bold claim that finally came true. Critics consider Al-Raisi's election as a big soft power victory for Abu Dhabi at the expense of Interpol's own reputation. In the words of U.S. Senator Roger Wicker, Interpol has become a tool in the hands of despots and crooks who seek to punish dissidents and political opponents in an effort to turn other countries' law enforcement against the rule of law. Under Al-Raisi's supervision, Abu Dhabi and Dubai became two of the world's most surveilled cities, which was accompanied by a crackdown on domestic criticism and dissent. Internationally speaking, al-Raisi's name is glued to a number of infamous cases, above all the case of Matthew Hedges, a British citizen. The new president of Interpol is accused of supervising the torture of Hedges when he was imprisoned in the UAE for nearly 7 months in 2018 on false charges of espionage during a study trip. Matthew says during his detention, he was beaten up, electrocuted, denied food and water, and given a cocktail of high-strength drugs to combat his panic attacks and depression. He was also reportedly forced to sign a confession in Arabic, a language he did not know.
I see the consequences so much as we see the consequences of Saudi being elected to the to chair the Human Rights Council in 2015. This is a act that basically proves that within these European centered organizations that it's ultimately money and capital and the geopolitical alliance with the West and with Israel that determines what kinds of acts of brutality can be carried out without impunity, essentially, and that essentially justice can be bought off within these organizations.
In reaction to al-Raisi's recent election, Hedges tweeted, "The inevitable election of Raisi to Interpol presidency is a serious attack on the values it stands for. His complicity in systematic torture and abuse is legitimized through Interpol and gives a green light to other authoritarian states that they can act without impunity." Interpol is entitled to issue red notices, called by one country for the arrest of individuals in another. Yet the body has often been accused of letting red notices to be misused by autocratic states to track down dissidents abroad. David Calvert-Smith, the former director of public prosecutions for England and Wales, says the UAE has misused the red notice system both for minor offenses and most importantly for political gain against those seen as a threat to the regime, concluding al-Raisi is unsuitable for the presidency.
Well, it allows him to cover up his previous acts of torture that he's known to have committed. And also, outside of just Raisi, but the UAE security apparatus, military apparatus in general, can continue its war crimes against Yemenis and continue to occupy Yemen, and especially the island of Socotra that I mentioned, that the UAE, since especially since 2017, 2018, but even decades prior, has been preferring to use as its military base. So essentially, this is like a way in which they're trying to buy their way out of any prosecution that should be dealt with.
Therefore, al-Raisi's election reveals little appetite, if any, for Interpol member states to reform the red notice system. Nabhan Al-Hanshi, head of ALQSD for Human Rights, believes Raisi's election sends a chilling message that Interpol has abandoned its human rights commitments. This raises fears that existing concerns about the agency, including the use of politically motivated red notices by abusive states, will worsen. The election of the notorious Emirati general as the head of Interpol is a warning to the international community that no one is immune from the abuse of Interpol and authoritarian regimes. Once used in the hunt for fugitive criminals, Interpol might drastically, though invisibly, change course in the years to come.
Thank you. today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Almighty. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, so welcome, Salamun Alaikum, peace and salutations of God be upon all of you, dear friend. You choose today's special from IRIB English Radio to listen to, and we're gonna speak about life after death in Islam. Today, Monday, is the first of the month of Jamadi al-Awwal, 1443 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 15th of the month of Azar, 1400 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 6th of December, 2021 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's open Allah's book, the Holy Quran, and we'll listen to chapter Nahl, verse 32.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Alladhina tatawaffahumul malaikatu tayyibin yaquluna salamun alaykum udkhulul jannata bima kuntum ta'malun.
The ones whom the angels take in death, being good and pure, the angels will say, peace be upon you. Enter paradise for what you used to do.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The previous holy verses, we read as to how the angels of death usually take the life, the arrogant pagans, while they are oppressors. Here in this noble verse, we read as to how the angels would take the life of those who are clean of everything and are clear of all oppressions, arrogance, and every kind of sin.
I'm so confused, tell me what's happened. So many voices in my head, but he told me that this day will come. Tell me, have I done enough? Ya Rabbi. Now my book's cold and closed, all my deeds are for show. So I lie here and wait for that day.
The topic of today's special for this episode is life after death in Islam. Imagine yourself at the moment of your death. What thoughts cross your mind? Memories of the family and friends? Panic? Regrets? Remembrance of Allah? What is death? What happens to us after we die? Sometimes we may not want to know about the processes that occur after we die because we are afraid or don't want to think about it. However, this is not the attitude of a Muslim. We should be foremost in learning and understanding death so we can live our lives accordingly. Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace and salutations of Allah be upon him and his pure progeny, said, "Live in this world as though you are a stranger or a traveler passing through it. We are on a journey and should know about the whole journey's itinerary, not just one part."
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we know, nobody lives in this world forever, so death comes to everybody. According to some scholars, according to some dignitaries, the world and the context of the world and the context of the grave is the interworld, the barzakh. Sometimes barzakh is translated as the purgatory. No, it isn't correct. The interworld is the world between this world and the next world. Okay, I mean the interworld means the world between leaving this world and entering the state of being dead and death up to the state of being resurrected on the day of resurrection. So it's indicated that people are really, everybody is expected to enter his own interworld, or the state of interworld after death. And in the state of the interworld, this physical body is going to be deteriorated, is going to be decayed. However, something like this world, this body, but not in a physical shape to be touched, would be ready for this, for the dead body. So that this, dead person, after being dead, after his death, after his or her death, would soon be questioned, interrogated, in the tomb. For the jobs he or she has done in this world. It's because of this that if the living people who are still alive, do something for the dead beloveds and dead relatives, the religious reward of those jobs would certainly be recorded in the spiritual record of the dead people. It's really very benefactory and beneficial for the dead people to receive such kind of rewards, such kind of gifts, spiritual gifts from the living relatives.
IRIB English Radio presents today's special, Every Day for 15 Minutes.
Be like the sun shining with light. Be like a rose spreading its fragrance in every part.
Today's special.
Be like the earth, humble and wise. Be like the rain.
Stage 3 of the life hereafter, grave's constriction or pressure of the grave. The constriction or pressure in the grave is a very terrifying stage, to the extent that it is not just difficult for the living to imagine, it is impossible to imagine. Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, has said the following about it. O servants of Allah, there is nothing harder on those who are not forgiven than death save the grave. So beware of its constriction, darkness, and loneliness. Each day the grave says, I am the abode of loneliness, I am the abode of worms. And the grave is either like one of the gardens of paradise or one of the pits of hell. Indeed, the life of hardship, about which Allah has warned those who are hostile to Him, is the torment in the grave. The unbeliever is assaulted as he is in his grave by 99 dragons that tear up his flesh, crush his bones, and keep visiting him thus till the day of resurrection. Had one of these dragons blown on earth, no vegetation would have either grown in it. O servants of Allah, your weak selves, tender and soft bodies, which are satisfied with little, are too weak to withstand all of this. As indicated, the sin, transgressions, and wrongdoings will each take a form in the hereafter, and the worst one is the worst its form will be? What will help during this difficult situation?
الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات لنبوئنهم من الجنة غرفا تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها نعم أجر العاملين.
Means to prepare for the final journey, a hidden good deed. Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, commanded us in an authentic narration to have what can be called a hidden good deed, as he said, "Whoever among you can afford to have good deeds stored in secret, let him do it." Consequently, you should have at least a good deed stored in secret. That's to have a concealed good deed or move between you and your Lord alone, with no one else knowing anything about it. If you do so, you will surely find what will please you with your Lord on the Day of Judgment by Allah's grace and favor.
Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, on the Day of Ashura, when he saw death racing to his companions and family members, some of them initially were shaken. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, what did he tell them? He said, "Sabran bani al-kiram, have patience, my beloved sons, the beloved sons of the generous ones, have patience. Fama al-mawtu illa qantara. Believe me that death is nothing but a bridge. Ta'bur bikum min al-bu'si wal-dharra. It's a bridge that takes you from misery to the reward of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to open gardens, والنعيم الدائمة, and eternal bliss. فأيكم يكره أن ينتقل من سجن إلى قصر. Is there a human being who does not desire to move out from a prison and go and settle in a palace? You're going to a palace. So have patience. This world is just a temporary transition point. When we talk about death and the akhirah, we're talking about the real permanent life. That's why it's so recommended in the religion of Islam to constantly think about death, because thinking about death keeps us prepared. It always keeps us in check to do that which is right. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, would constantly urge his companions, think of death, the death which will end the worldly pleasures for us, death which will end our gatherings in this life. It really gives life to our hearts.
Dear friend, that was all with today's special about life after death in Islam. Of course, just for today. Inshallah, we continue this topic. So, till another episode, we leave you in Allah's protection. Fi aman Allah, and have a nice time.
From those around, I hear a cry, a muffled sob, a hopeless sigh. I hear the footsteps leaving slow. A chilly wind begins to blow within my soul from head to toe. And then last breath escapes my lips. It's time to leave and I must go. So it is true, but it's too late. They said each soul has its given day. Well, it must leave its body's core and meet with this eternal fate.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.